You're listening to Justice Radio on WMPG. This is the monthly Youth Justice segment with the Young People's Caucus, and your hosts, Liv and Swathi. Today is the first half of a two-part series with Brandon Brown about revisioning conflict narratives. Brandon Brown is the executive director of Youth-Led Justice, a loving father, an activist, and a generally cool guy.
On a podcast that I've been listening to called 1 Million Experiments, that's about like just really important projects that are going on across the country that are like alternatives to policing in the carceral system. Anyway, they ask everyone they interview, so I'm asking you, in this time, and however you define time, so it can be this hour, this day, this season, this lifetime, how is the world treating you, and how are you treating the world?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think I define this time as all the ways that you offered, right? Because this moment matters, this life matters, this month mattered, this year for me mattered really like a lot, right? So the world is treating me okay. You know, it's treating me with opportunities, and it's treating me, but also with obstacles, right? And I think that's something that we always learn to navigate both at the same time or sometimes individually. But the world is treating me good because I'm a dad, you know, and that's really the biggest thing in my life and the only thing that truly, truly matters to me. And in the context of talking about youth work, the day I became a father, youth work started to be personal to me, you know, more than it was before becoming a father. So, you know, the world is treating me with obstacles because I have a daughter in a different country, right? So it's not a traditional parenting situation. So figuring out travel, figuring out law, right? Today, the world is treating me strangely because I have fear for my daughter because of immigration conversations. I have fear for her mother. And I also have motivation to be involved in a political world that I've never felt compelled to be involved in before. Because it could potentially impact my ability to be a father, right? And just for context, I had to fight for that ability to begin with because I was on probation when my daughter was born. So I had to fight the state just to be present as a father in a different country in order to get my probation terminated. So, you know, I've been victorious. So I feel like the world is treating me, you know, fairly sometimes and most of the time by giving me the opportunities to fight. But, you know, sometimes I feel like the world is treating me unfair just because that's how life feels sometimes. And then how I'm treating the world, you know, I'm treating the world better than I'm treating myself. I'll say that. Because I think with somebody with my life experiences, self-care is the hardest thing to figure out. It's a lot easier to care for the world around you and the people around you when care was the one thing that you wanted for so long. So, you know, being in prison for over a decade, I just wanted to connect with people and show up and, you know, be in the world. And now that I'm in it, that still feels very important to me. So I try to treat the world with compassion because there's too much division. And so I try not to participate in that because everywhere you turn, you're surrounded by it. So, you know, try to be like that cliche light in the dark anytime I can be, and in hopes that the world will give it back to me in the moments of need.
Thank you for all of that.
Yeah.
I realized that maybe we should have introed first, but we'd also love to hear who you are and, yeah, whatever you want to share about who you are and what your work is in relation to youth justice.
Yeah, I feel like who are you is always the hardest question I've ever had to answer because I'm still figuring it out, specifically, you know, in the workspace. But, you know, my name is Brandon Brown, and currently I am the executive director of Youth-Led Justice. We are a restorative justice organization based in Portland and Lewiston, Maine. And our work revolves around, you know, caring for young people in a time of need through the pathway of teaching them accountability, I would say is like our primary objective. So, you know, historically, we've done diversion work. So when a young person gets arrested and is introduced into the formal criminal legal system, our program is a pathway out of that system, right? Out of the harms and the traumas and all of the, you know, stuff that comes with experiencing the carceral space. We understand that when young people experience that, it's that you can't reverse the effects. It's not possible. It's long lasting. And so that's the work that I believe in, you know, as somebody who has experienced the system, basically. And so, you know, when somebody asks me, who am I? I am not the type of person to ever feel ashamed or hide from my past. You know, I am a person who is in recovery from long-term incarceration. I was in prison for 12 years. I first entered the system in 2008, and I was released from it in 2021. So, you know, 13 years of my life were dictated by a trauma-inducing carceral system, but also were the result of a really terrible mistake I made as a 21-year-old. And then just because I got out of the system in 2021, I was still wrapped up in it until just very recently, because I was on supervised community confinement and probation, and all of my movements and everything were dictated and monitored by that same system that physically held me at one point. So my experience with prison dictates everything I do personally, professionally, and in between, right? And so currently, I'm the executive director of Youth-Led Justice. Previous to that, I was with another youth-serving organization that was a legislative campaign to try to close down our youth prison. Previous to that, I was, you know, a faculty at a university working directly with system-impacted kids, not just in the carceral space, but also foster care and, you know, other broken systems that we have in our communities. And previous to that, I was a volunteer in the youth prison, and I arrived at all of those, you know, roles because when I was incarcerated, 75% of men that I met in the Maine Department of Corrections had some type of interaction with a broken system before they were an adult. And so over my time being in prison, I started realizing that I could count millions of negative experiences that my community had had before they had the capability to make a decision on what systems they interacted with, and that those experiences led them to a very negative one as an adult in prison. And more importantly, that the ripples of those broken systems affected way more people than we actually believe they affect when, you know, we're subjecting youth to these negative experiences. So, you know, who am I? I am somebody who wants to see our systems stop wreaking havoc in our communities and wants to see our systems create pathways for people to thrive in our communities, specifically and especially when crime occurs and when conflict occurs. And the last thing I'll say about who am I, I'm a PhD candidate, right? Studying peace and conflict resolution. I'm somebody who believes in the power of education. I took my first class, my first college class ever in prison, and I took the last class for my PhD while I was still in prison, and that was a pathway to freedom, even in a place where freedom felt unobtainable. And so, you know, one day I'll finish my PhD, hopefully sooner than later, but it is a very important part of my identity because I know that education is, you know, a method of healing when we're doing it right.
Oh my God, I'm so curious to hear more at another time about your peace and conflict studies. Studies.
Yeah.
Also, you know, like, you know, those people who maybe you don't, but those people who like you talk with and you're like, oh, like you make our work make so much sense. You just make our work make so much sense, Brandon.
No, I
really, like the people
that
who like bring like, yeah, just like bring some clarity. It like locks into place when we talk.
I appreciate
that. So thank you for that.
You feel it too.
Yeah.
I mean, you have to. That's the most important part about this work. You know, I've worked with people. I've worked with plenty of people. And that's the first question I ask them, you know, after a period of time of working with them is like, do you feel this?
Yeah.
You know, like, do when you go home at night, do you leave work behind? And I don't mean like the reports. I mean the feeling.
Yeah.
Because you can't.
Yeah.
You know, you can. That's why I said earlier, too, as a dad, I can never leave this work behind because I understand my daughter has obstacles just because of my life experience that she didn't choose.
Yeah.
So I will never be able to lay my head down at night without thinking about how to make my community a better and safer place and how to make young people have opportunities to chase their wildest dreams and thrive and be successful and not be traumatized by systems, right? Because I know that my daughter will experience it at some point. And so I have to be prepared for that, you know? So I don't, you know, feeling this work is actually the only prerequisite I think should matter on an application to do the work, not your education, not your work experience. You know, you give me one person who feels it to their core and I'll take them over 10 people who studied it academically.
Yeah. Okay. You kind of helped take us into this dream space, but that's where we want to go next. We've been, Liv and I have been talking a lot about this, and I think now the whole world is talking about Octavia Butler. but I think her sci-fi has taught us a lot about how to like really talk about the worlds that we imagine. And some, you know, some of hers are real dark, but like we want to live in the dream space of what you envision for how schools or communities support young people to work through conflict.
Yeah. Oh man, the dream is, you know, that everybody starts to care right? That's just one of the foundations of the dream. And I'm just gonna pause for a second and say, like, I am not somebody who gets involved in a lot of politics, right? Because I understand that politics historically have always caused division. There's like not any way around it, right? Mm-hmm. When you have like especially a two-party or even a 10-party system, like there's going to be divisions because people have different beliefs. But I saw something recently, and I think it was old. I don't even know when it was from, but I saw a reel on Instagram, and it was like a sports reporter that was like, I refuse to report on sports because we just had another school shooting and I have to talk about that, right? And some of the things that he said hit me so hard to my core, because when we talk about what the dream is safety, right? The dream is like positive development. The dream is having young people's needs met because they don't have the capacity to meet them themselves. And that's our social responsibility. And when we think about that, how normal it is to live in a country where a school shooting happens, we've become so desensitized to it. And we always think it's tragic, right? But one of the things this guy said is like, we send our prayers and what we see how much good that does, right? But what we don't send is like legislation that can actually make a difference. What we don't send is resources that, like, non-carceral resources, so not bars on the door and metal detectors inside, but resources to actually heal the people who are, you know, survivors of this violence, but also to heal people who are perpetrators of this violence, because that's not a conversation that we have enough, right? So when I think about the dream, what I think about is at first I go to the extreme. Why do these extremely bad things happen? And I don't believe that a healthy, healed, thriving person in any capacity can perpetrate an extreme act of violence. I don't believe that somebody who has attention being paid to their needs would, you know, resort to even a small act of violence, because we live in a society where we isolate, right? We exclude people who seem like they don't, quote unquote, belong, you know, and we normalize like this party system, even in our relationships in schools, right? In schools, we call them cliques. In the adult world, we call them politics. Right? So we've normalized this like divisive world. And what I think I dream of, you know, when I lay my head down or even when my eyes are wide open, is like a community and a school and a world that when somebody hurts somebody else, whether that's with words or violence or whatever, that instead of punishing them, we ask them what's wrong, right? I've hurt a lot of people in my life. I've never hurt somebody when I wasn't hurting. When I'm not hurting, I want to lift people up. I want to connect with them. I want to love them. I want to see them smile. When I'm hurting, I don't, right? So I want to live in a dream world where how we respond to things that hurt is with love, not with hate, not with punishment. And the specifics of that are vast, right? And it really depends on where we're talking and what system we're talking about, and like also what the culture of somewhere is that we're talking about, because what love as a response look like isn't the same everywhere, right? It's got to be dependent on the person in need. And so, you know, that's what my dream world looks like, is like, let's stop believing that when somebody hurts somebody, that the best thing to do is hurt them back. And that's a suspension, and that's an expulsion, and that's a detention, and that's a strong verbal reprimand that doesn't actually ask about the root causes of pain, right? Those things hurt, and they've never helped us get to where we need to be.
I've been thinking a lot about what you were saying about the divisions, like political divisions, like, or politics necessarily dividing us, and how it like pits us against each other, and then whenever any change happens, that means like one group won and one group lost. And that's just like this forever dynamic. And that's like swinging us between the two groups that are winning and losing, and then like being energized and wanting to like win again. Anyway, I've been thinking a lot about like what that last step then of like of a campaign for change could look like, that last step of like reconciliation, where you like get what maybe your group was fighting for, and then like look to the people who were your opponents and be like, what, how do we like live in this new world together? You know, like that final step of like, let's like, and it, I'm so curious if like your peace and conflict studies relate to that, or like just where, who's done that well, you know, feels like a really necessary thing that we need to like figure out as a society is how to like bring everyone into a changed world, or else we're like, I don't know, see how we get out of like the swinging.
Yeah. I mean, the easy response that I can process right now is maybe not an answer as much as it is a question, right? But it's like we live in a world here in the United States, at least, where we believe that like media coverage and legislation is what equates to victory.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Do you know how many laws exist in the United States that don't actually have any practical application or enforcement? Like, mm-hmm. So we pass a law and we feel victorious, and then we forget that a law is just a piece of paper. It's a social concept, right? It's a construct. It's not even enforceable unless we put resources into it. And so for me, like when we look at this partied system where one side is battling against the other side for like a popular vote, right? Because that's what we live in, a majority rules culture, right? In every single aspect of our life, it's a majority rules culture. But we forget that actually the work starts when the law is passed.
Mm-hmm.
The work starts when the ordinance is passed, if it's local. The work starts when a vote has occurred, whether it's at a school board, at a community meeting, wherever it is, all that work that led up to the vote, the campaigning, the research, the thought, the like think tanks, if we think about all that work that felt like it was like Herculean to do that work, actually doesn't matter the day that something is voted on and a majority has ruled.
Yeah.
It's what happens after that is the work that matters. Yeah. And the reason is because if we look at like some things in this country that are, that should be, in my personal opinion, really common sense that every single person, regardless of what your beliefs, your background or anything is, should be common sense, right? Like I'm a person who believes that a woman's right to choose is common sense, that there's no religion or belief or anything that should dictate that a woman does not have autonomy over her body, right? We forget that regardless of what the law says, that's the work we need to do, is understand why the opposition feels the opposite.
Yeah.
But that's, we live in a divided culture that's, you know, about, like you mentioned, victory. And we live in a culture that forgets that just because a vote has happened doesn't mean the work has happened.
You're listening to Justice Radio with Liv and Swathi and our guest, Brandon Brown. Now we're going to bring this conversation into restorative justice.
I'm going to like pedal back and like try and recontextualize it for us in like a way that might be more friendly or accepted. I don't know. But I was, as you guys were talking through all of this, I'm thinking a lot of media and socialization and education and like what's like the way that youth get like most of their socialization and education. It's through movies and TV and all of that. And I think that we've seen it like move and progress like in like the recent years. Like it's definitely changing and moving towards like restorative justice tendencies. But like, I think historically, film and movies and even like books and the way that plot lines have been taught to us is in terms of like moving to like a heightened like climax in the storyline. But then there's always a protagonist and an antagonist. There's a good guy and a bad guy. And there's always like these really polarizing storylines within like all of like the media that we consume.
Mm-hmm.
And so like, obviously that's going to like translate into our real lives. And if we can't like get away from like having typical stories of like good versus bad. Well, also the other thing is like these movies are like an hour and a half long. And when the plot ends, we also, like you were saying, we don't see how people start moving forward in like other creative and nuanced ways. And we only see like one perspective from a book. So I guess like, I don't know exactly how to bring this back in like a succinct question to restorative justice, but like, how do we teach our youth different ways of thinking and knowing and being when everything around us is teaching us to be on opposing views and on opposing sides, mm-hmm. and that the energy and the excitement is in the problem.
Yeah. And I'm not going to nerd out too hard right now. Normally I would in other circumstances, but like you said something that matters so much. And it's that, so like just for context, what I study in the field of peace and conflict resolution is narratives and how they operate to fuel conflict or resolve conflict, right? How social narratives are distributed, how power affects narratives, like all of these aspects of how the stories we tell are the most important thing when it comes to the conflict we're in. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that I heard you saying that really matters to me is like, we have to redefine the narrative arc of society, but definitely of conflict. And so like the narrative arc that you're talking about is that arc that says like, it's a traditional arc and there's a climactic point, and after that, we're on the downslope. Restorative justice and peace and really anything that matters is actually a whole different arc where the point that we normally think as being climactic is actually only like one third of the way up the rise. We need to re-envision the arc to be a whole lot more rise and a whole lot less fall, right? And when it flattens out is actually closer to the top than we've ever historically envisioned it. And when we're thinking about politics or we're thinking about division of any kind, we do adopt that traditional narrative arc approach, which is like that climactic point is when a change happens. And then the post, like the decline that flattens out about halfway down is the work that happens after the climactic point. It's not, that's not how society should work. When we know something needs to change, that what we view as the climactic point should actually be closer to the beginning than we've ever envisioned.
Yeah.
Because the real top of the arc should be defined by transformation, right? In, so when we're thinking about like conflict in the context of restorative justice, the top of the arc is when a harm occurs right now. That's how we envision it. The top of that arc should be when accountability has been met and transformation has occurred for all people, including those who were harmed and those who were responsible for doing the harm. So the actual incident, so like if we think about this in the context of schools, there's a big fight at a school. 12 kids get in a big group fight, 6-on-6. That is not the climactic point, right? That's actually the beginning, right? And it's everything that mattered before that. Everything that happened before that matters. But that fight, that conflict is not the top of the arc, right? It's like 20% up the incline. And then all the work you do to get to the top is that, that we call that pre-work, right? Pre-work is so important. But the circle is not the top of the arc either. The circle is halfway, right? When we do a reparative circle with people who are harmed and people who are responsible, a lot of times the restorative justice field or even society views that as like the resolution. No, it is not, right? The resolution is the work that happens after the circle, right? So like once we call it in like our formal language, we call it like a repair agreement where all parties involved agree that this is how you as the responsible party can fix this, and how me as a harmed person will feel more comfortable and confident and healed by the work you've done. The conclusion of that is the top, right? So it's like we have such a, we, I mean, this is America. We have a very short attention span. We have a very short memory, right? We have a very short tolerance, and we all have very short fuses for the most part. And that narrative arc is a product of that. We want things to be done,
settled.
And happen.
Yeah.
And that's why, like, you know, when we're talking about the need for restorative justice and the need for safer schools with alternatives to punishment, we live in a carceral society that fulfills that desire for the finality of things and for things to happen quickly. Because when you send somebody to prison or when you expel them, it usually happens very soon after a conflict. Right? And it feels good. Okay, I can move on from this. But the truth is, you don't move on from the effects of what happened just because somebody is out of sight. Like we believe out of sight, out of mind, right? And that's true in a lot of contexts. It's not true in the context of conflict, right? Out of sight, out of mind does not equate to healing or repair of any kind. And so like that arc, I think, is such a good visual to provide mm-hmm. is we have to redefine how much incline or slope there is to get to before we can actually experience a climactic moment
yeah.
and what it means to come down from that climactic moment, that yeah. climax afterwards, right? And what how we define the moment where we can say, okay, now we're on the downslope. But mm-hmm. yeah,
it's what to glorify.
Yeah.
Like of it all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Which we glorify punishment right now.
Yeah.
That's the only thing we know. Right. And we wonder if we look at any system, no matter what it is, we're talking about like employment, schools at every level. Kids are getting suspended from kindergarten.
Yeah.
I have a friend whose kid got suspended from kindergarten for biting a kid.
Holy shit.
We're talking about like a 3 or 4 year old or 2, or like not even kindergarten. I think it was daycare, right? Like your kid can't come back to daycare for a week because they yeah. bit somebody. It's like, that's my kid has 2 teeth. Like
yeah.
she bites stuff.
Yeah.
That's not, she doesn't do it with malice. So why would we punish her, yeah. right? Instead of showing her that some things are biteable and some things are not.
Yeah.
But we live in a culture where we have normalized this so much.
Yeah.
And it's, we have to get away from it.
In legislation right now, there's LD 165, which is an act to allow school boards to expel or suspend students regardless of grade level.
Why is that there?
That's crazy.
That's crazy.
And also, what does that mean? What are the standards that are dictating, right, like that as a norm?
Yeah.
And also, so this is another thing, you know, about the political process in our world that's really interesting. Anybody can propose anything. They don't ever have to talk to anybody in the community about it. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't, like, we know that for the most part, you know, bills are passed by popularity, but bills are not introduced by popularity. You can, as a person in power, can introduce a bill about anything. You could introduce a bill to make farts illegal.
Mm-hmm.
And it's probably not going to pass because that's crazy, right? But it's somebody can propose it.
Yeah.
And that piece of legislation you just listed is a perfect example of, like, if you have a child, there's no way that you can support that legislation, or that you should, in my opinion. Because if my child is in first grade, you should not be able to expel them no matter what happens, because yeah. they are not developed enough to understand their actions. That's our job as a society to teach them.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening to Justice Radio. Tune in next month for part 2 of our conversation with Brandon. And a big thank you to Samuel James for his gift of music that opens and closes each episode in our series.